Chapter 13. And then what do you reckon she did? Why, she turned on that smirking Spanish fool like a wildcat, and out with a navy, and shot him dead in open court. That was spirited, I am willing to admit. Wasn't it, though? Said the judge admiringly. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I adjourned court right on the spot, and we put on our coats, and went out, and took up a collection for her and her cubs, and sent them over the mountains to their friends. Ah, she was a spirited wench. Information wanted, Ashington, December 10, 1867. Could you give me any information respecting such islands, if any, as the government is going to purchase? It is an uncle of mine that wants to know. He is an industrious man and well-disposed, and wants to make a living in an honest, humble way, but more especially he wants to be quiet. He wishes to settle down, and be quiet and unostentatious. He has been to the New Island St. Thomas, but he says he thinks things are unsettled there. He went there early with an attaché of the State Department, who was sent down with money, to pay for the island. My uncle had his money in the same box, and so when they went ashore, getting a receipt, the sailors broke open the box, and took all the money, not making any distinction between government money, which was legitimate money to be stolen, and my uncle's, which was his own private property, and should have been respected. But he came home, and got some more and went back. And then he took the fever. There are 7 kinds of fever down there, you know, and, as his blood was out of order by reason of loss of sleep and general wear and tear of mind, he failed to cure the first fever, and then somehow he got the other 6. He is not a kind of man that enjoys fevers, though he is well-meaning, and always does what he thinks is right, and so he was a good deal annoyed, when it appeared he was going to die. But he worried through, and got well, and started a farm. He fenced it in, and the next day, that great storm came on, and washed the most of it over to Gibraltar, or around there somewhere. He only said, in his patient way, that it was gone, and he wouldn't bother about trying to find out where it went to, though it was his opinion it went to Gibraltar. Then he invested in a mountain, and started a farm up there, so as to be out of the way, when the sea came ashore again. It was a good mountain, and a good farm, but it wasn't any use. An earthquake came the next night, and shook it all down. It was all fragments, you know, and so mixed up with another man's property, that he could not tell which were his fragments without going to law. And he would not do that, because his main object in going to St. Thomas, was to be quiet. All that he wanted, was to settle down and be quiet. He thought it all over, and finally he concluded to try the low ground again, especially as he wanted to start a brickyard this time. He bought a flat, and put out 100,000 bricks, to dry preparatory to baking them. But luck appeared to be against him. A volcano shoved itself through there that night, and elevated his brickyard about 2,000 feet in the air. It irritated him a good deal. He has been up there, and he says the bricks are all baked right enough, but he can't get them down. At first, he thought maybe the government would get the bricks down for him, because since government bought the island, it ought to protect the property where a man has invested in good faith. But all he wants is quiet, and so he is not going to apply for the subsidy he was thinking about. He went back there last week in a couple of ships of war, to prospect around the coast for a safe place for a farm, where he could be quiet. But a great idle wave came, and hoisted both of the ships out into one of the interior counties, and he came near losing his life. So he has given up prospecting in a ship, and is discouraged. Well, now he don't know what to do. He has tried Alaska, but the bears kept after him so much, and kept him so much on the jump, as it were, that he had to leave the country. He could not be quiet there with those bears prancing after him all the time. That is how he came to go to the new island we have bought, St. Thomas. But he is getting to think St. Thomas is not quiet enough for a man of his turn of mind, and that is why he wishes me to find out if government is likely to buy some more islands shortly. He has heard that government is thinking about buying Puerto Rico. If that is true, he wishes to try Puerto Rico, if it is a quiet place. How is Puerto Rico for his style of man? Do you think the government will buy it? Some learned fables, for good old boys and girls, in three parts. Part first, how the animals of the wood sent out a scientific expedition, once the creatures of the forest, held a great convention, and appointed a commission consisting of the most illustrious scientists among them to go forth, clear beyond the forest, and out into the unknown and unexplored world, to verify the truth of the matters already taught in their schools and colleges, and also to make discoveries. It was the most imposing enterprise of the kind the nation had ever embarked in. True, the government had once sent Dr. Bullfrog, with a picked crew, to hunt for a northwesterly passage through the swamp to the right-hand corner of the wood, and had since sent out many expeditions to hunt for Dr. Bullfrog. But they never could find him, and so government finally gave him up, and ennobled his mother, to show its gratitude for the services her son had rendered to science. And once government sent Sir Grasshopper, to hunt for the sources of the rill, that emptied into the swamp, and afterward sent out many expeditions, to hunt for Sir Grass, and at last they were successful. They found his body, but if he had discovered the sources meantime, he did not let on. So government acted handsomely by deceased, and many envied his funeral. But these expeditions were trifles compared with the present one, for this one comprised among its servants the very greatest among the learned, and besides it was to go to the utterly unvisited regions believed to lie beyond the mighty forest, as we have remarked before. How the members were banqueted, and glorified, and talked about. Everywhere that one of them showed himself, straightway there was a crowd to gape and stare at him. Finally they set off, and it was a sight to see the long procession of dry land tortoises heavily laden with savants, scientific instruments, glowworms and fireflies for signal service, provisions, ants, and tumblebugs to fetch and carry and delve, spiders to carry the surveying chain, and do other engineering duty, and so forth and so on. And after the tortoises came another long train of ironclads, stately and spacious mud turtles for marine transportation service, and from every tortoise and every turtle flaunted a flaming gladiolus or other splendid banner, at the head of the column a great band of bumblebees, mosquitoes, katydids, and crickets discoursed martial music, and the entire train was under the escort and protection of 12 picked regiments of the army worm. At the end of 3 weeks the expedition emerged from the forest and looked upon the great unknown world. Their eyes were greeted with an impressive spectacle. A vast level plain stretched before them, watered by a sinuous stream, and beyond there towered up against the sky a long and lofty barrier of some kind, they did not know what. The tumblebug said he believed it was simply land tilted upon its edge, because he knew he could see trees on it. But Professor Snail and the other said, "You are hired to dig, sir, that is all. We need your muscle, not your brains. When we want your opinion on scientific matters, we will hasten to let you know. Your coolness is intolerable, to loafing about here meddling with august matters of learning, when the other laborers are pitching camp. Go along and help handle the baggage." The tumblebug turned on his heel uncrushed, unabashed, observing to himself, "If it isn't land tilted up, let me die the death of the unrighteous." Professor Bullfrog, nephew of the late explorer, said he believed the ridge was the wall that enclosed the earth. He continued, "Our fathers have left us much learning, but they had not traveled far, and so we may count this a noble new discovery. We are safe for renown now, even though our labors began and ended with this single achievement. I wonder what this wall is built of? Can it be fungus? Fungus is an honorable good thing, to build a wall of. Professor Snail adjusted his field glass and examined the rampart critically. Finally, he said, "The fact that it is not diaphanous convinces me that it is a dense vapor formed by the calorification of ascending moisture dephlogisticated by refraction. A few diametrical experiments would confirm this, but it is not necessary. The thing is obvious." So he shut up his glass and went into his shell to make a note of the discovery of the world's end and the nature of it. "Profound mind," said Professor Angleworm to Professor Field Mouse. "Profound mind. Nothing can long remain a mystery to that august brain." Night drew on apace, the sentinel crickets were posted, the glowworm and firefly lamps were lighted, and the camp sank to silence and sleep. After breakfast in the morning, the expedition moved on. About noon a great avenue was reached, which had in the two endless parallel bars of some kind of hard black substance, raised the height of the tallest bullfrog, above the general level. The scientists climbed upon these and examined, and tested them in various ways. They walked along them for a great distance, but found no end, and no break in them. They could arrive at no decision. There was nothing in the records of science that mentioned anything of this kind. But at last the bald and venerable geographer, Professor Mud Turtle, a person who, born poor and of a drudging low family, had, by his own native force raised himself to the headship of the geographers of his generation, said, "My friends, we have indeed made a discovery here. We have found in a palpable, compact, and imperishable state what the wisest of our fathers always regarded as a mere thing of the imagination. Humble yourselves, my friends, for we stand in a majestic presence. These are parallels of latitude." Every heart and every head was bowed, so awful, so sublime was the magnitude of the discovery. Many shed tears. The camp was pitched, and the rest of the day given up to writing voluminous accounts of the marvel, and correcting astronomical tables to fit it. Toward midnight a demoniacal shriek was heard, then a clattering and rumbling noise, and the next instant a vast terrific eye shot by, with a long tail attached, and disappeared in the gloom, still uttering triumphant shrieks. The poor damp laborers were stricken to the heart with fright, and stampeded for the high grass in a body. But not the scientists. They had no superstitions. They calmly proceeded to exchange theories. The ancient geographer's opinion was asked. He went into his shell and deliberated long and profoundly. When he came out at last, they all knew by his worshipping countenance that he brought light. Said he, "Give thanks for this stupendous thing which we have been permitted to witness. It is the vernal equinox." There were shoutings and great rejoicings. "But," said the angleworm, uncoiling after reflection, "this is dead summer time." "Very well," said the turtle, "we are far from our region. The season differs with the difference of time between the two points." "Ah, true. True enough. But it is night. How should the sun pass in the night? In these distant regions he doubtless passes always in the night at this hour." "Yes, doubtless that is true. But it being night, how is it that we could see him?" "It is a great mystery. I grant that. But I am persuaded that the humidity of the atmosphere in these remote regions is such that particles of daylight adhere to the disk, and it was by aid of these that we were enabled to see the sun in the dark." This was deemed satisfactory, and due entry was made of the decision. But about this moment those dreadful shriekings were heard again. Again the rumbling and thundering came speeding up out of the night, and once more a flaming great eye flashed by, and lost itself in gloom and distance. The camp laborers gave themselves up for lost. The savants were sorely perplexed. Here was a marvel hard to account for. They thought and they talked and they thought. Finally the learned and aged Lord Granddaddy Longlegs, who had been sitting in deep study, with his slender limbs crossed and his stemmy arms folded, said, deliver your opinions, brethren, and then I will tell my thought, for I think I have solved this problem. So be it, good your lordship, piped the weak treble of the wrinkled and withered Professor Woodlouse, for we shall hear from your lordship's lips naught but wisdom. Here the speaker threw in a mess of trite, threadbare, exasperating quotations from the ancient poets and philosophers, delivering them with unction in the sounding grandeurs of the original tongues, they being from the Mastodon, the Dodo, and other dead languages. Perhaps I ought not to presume to meddle with matters pertaining to astronomy at all, in such a presence as this, I who have made it the business of my life, to delve only among the riches of the extinct languages, and unearth the opulence of their ancient lore. But still, as unacquainted as I am with the noble science of astronomy, I beg with deference and humility, to suggest that inasmuch as the last of these wonderful apparitions proceeded in exactly the opposite direction from that pursued by the first, which you decide to be the vernal equinox, and greatly resembled it in all particulars, is it not possible, nay certain, that this last is the autumnal equi, Go to bed. Go to bed. With annoyed derision from everybody. So the poor old woodlouse retreated out of sight, consumed with shame. Further discussion followed, and then the united voice of the commission begged Lord Longlegs to speak. He said, "Fellow scientists, it is my belief that we have witnessed a thing which has occurred in perfection, but once before in the knowledge of created beings. It is a phenomenon of inconceivable importance and interest, view it as one may, but its interest to us is vastly heightened by an added knowledge of its nature which no scholar has heretofore possessed or even suspected. This great marvel which we have just witnessed, fellow savants, it almost takes my breath away, is nothing less than the transit of Venus." Every scholar sprang to his feet pale with astonishment. Then ensued tears, handshakings, frenzied embraces, and the most extravagant jubilations of every sort. But by and by, as emotion began to retire within bounds, and reflection to return to the front, the accomplished Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.